Hello everyone, welcome to the latest episode of the Artemis Live podcast. It's been a couple of weeks since we last had an episode for you. It's been a very busy time in the market and obviously there's been hurricanes in the water, so apologies for the gap in service. Today we have a session for you from our Artemis ILS Asia 2020 conference that was held in July. And this is a keynote speech from Paul Schultz, the Chief Executive Officer of Aon Securities, which is the capital markets and insurance and securities focused unit of insurance and reinsurance broker Aon. He gave us a keynote speech with slides, which obviously you're not going to get to see today, but I think the audio speaks for itself. And Paul shares some really interesting insights into the ILS market's growth potential in Asia and also globally around the world. In particular, he highlights the protection gap issue in Asia Pacific, the fact that the trend of insured versus uninsured losses is not really improving and is unsustainable in his view. But he also highlights that the insurance and securities market has a significant role to play here and could be integral in addressing these issues as well. He also feels that ILS is set for further growth and points out that sponsors in the ILS market are likely to become more numerous and also more expansive in the kinds of sponsors we see as well. Schultz says that we should expect to see more corporates and governments well represented within future ILS issuance, not just in Asia, but also globally around the world as well. So hope you enjoy this episode and we'll try to bring you more frequent episodes over the coming weeks.
Hello everyone, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are. Thank you for joining this session of our ILS Asia 2020 conference. Thank you to anybody who dialed in earlier today for a fantastic panel discussion about parametric risk transfer. This is our first sort of keynote with slides of the event, and I'm delighted to welcome Paul Schultz, CEO of Aon Securities. He's going to be giving a keynote on ILS in Asia, its history, the current market, and future outlook as well. Paul's unit and team at Aon Securities are intrinsically involved in the origination, structuring, arranging, distribution of ILS, ranging from catastrophe bonds to reinsurance sidecars, other collateralized reinsurance arrangements as well. Also heavily involved in the capital raising and investment banking side of reinsurance in general. And has a long history in the ILS space and has probably been involved or touched on as many transactions as anybody else, particularly in the cat bond market, I would say. Paul's going to present his keynote, after which we'll have time for some questions and answers as well. Please do submit your questions in the box in the interface in front of you. We'll get to these at the end of the presentation. If you want to resize the video window or the slides that you see in front of you, you can do. And I hope you enjoy this and make the most of hearing from one of the sort of longest standing executives in the ILS industry. So, Paul, welcome, and I'll just hand over to you.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the invitation. Look forward to at some point getting back to Singapore and having this more of a physical in-person discussion than virtual, but appreciate the opportunity. And certainly, good to connect with a lot of you. It's been a couple of years since I've been in Singapore and participated in this conference, but we're going to use a lot of the same slides that we used last time, just to kind of build on the story, kind of show continuity, show where there's been some development and things like that. So as Steve noted, really focused, a little bit. So just touch briefly on kind of what's happened, just to set the tone and use that to inform kind of how we think about expectations going forward. A little bit more about the current market and kind of we'll take a little bit of liberty and go maybe do some adjacencies here a little bit in that discussion. And then hopefully have, some perspective on what can happen and what we might expect, in the future. Coming out of Asia Pacific more broadly around ILS. So with that, we'll jump right into the history. kind of a busy slide, and kind of given our role in the industry, we're happy that it's a busy slide. So I think a couple takeaways from this, and this is predominantly a Kanban slide. You'll note that where we have included kind of sidecar transactions, those are specifically kind of labeled as such in this slide. But when you just look at the slide in its totality and really think about the years kind of 2000 to 2010, so that 10-year period, and then you contrast that with the activity over the last 10 years, you'll see here, you can just see it by the number of transactions, but if you were to count those up, the increase has been more than twofold in the last 10 years. And I think that really sets the stage for kind of what we would expect in the future. And as I said, given where we sit, that 2x multiple on it, is exciting, and we're certainly happy to be part of it. I think other takeaways here is that clearly ILS has been embedded, with a few sponsors, and given kind of the repeat nature of transactions here and the names and the sponsors and things like that, we think that that's very healthy, which just shows that ILS has become, kind of a foundational, form of risk transfer for sponsors and cedents in the region. And we look basically, to replicate that with others as we grow the market going forward. The third point, which, we'll touch a little bit on as we go through the entire presentation, but, not particularly evident on this slide, is but that we've used different features, different structural features across this timeline, certainly as you go back to the early days, but even, in the last 10 years, what we find is that even repeat sponsors have changed the way that they issue into the market. So taking advantage of the structural flexibility that exists and kind of using that structural flexibility to solve for different types, of solutions that sponsors and students are looking for. Clearly, introduction of new perils. And so, we have China and Philippines kind of represented in the last few years, and then new domiciles. So kind of all of that is really setting the stage for how we think about the market and kind of the opportunities going forward. We would like to highlight kind of what we think is one of the largest success stories in Asia, and by the way, kind of one of the largest success stories in kind of the ILS market kind of globally. So Zenkirin is the second largest sponsor of cat bonds globally, obviously the largest in Asia. Have been active for more than 15 years. And so really a testament to kind of the longevity of the markets, kind of the innovation or the pioneering kind of effort that Zenkirin kind of launched this effort back in 2003. Note that there is a recovery. And so as you look to the green numbers on the slides, obviously you can see that in 2003, Zenk started by issuing, kind of call it approximately $500 million kind of recovery in 2011. And so, one of the things that we keep looking for are the proof points that the market is working as expected. And, given the large earthquake event in 2011, if for some reason there wouldn't have been a recovery, that would have obviously been, defining point in the history of this. But I would say kind of worked as expected, kind of a proof point there. And then growing, really then over the last 10 years, from the relatively small amounts of notional put into the market to, approximately $2 billion today. So all of that, kind of, really important for the development, as a leader in the space, as a development of the market over this period of time. And again, you can see a few of the structural comments here that I mentioned in the prior slide, but the range of issuance included second event cover, parametric cover, moving to indemnity structures, moving to annual aggregate, and then moving to sort of a multi-year kind of aggregate approach. So very flexible in the way that Zenkirin has embraced this market, and certainly from the investor side, the fact that they've been able to grow as Zinc and their needs and desires to kind of grow this market, support the market, has been very impressive over the last 15 years. Okay, so with that backdrop then, what I would like to move into is just kind of how do we think about the current market? And here, you can kind of read those numbers, and I won't necessarily, call out all of them. But the importance of Asia Pacific, for global GDP is obvious. It's going to be important. It is important today. Definitively, it's going to be more important as we look forward. So, the current market is that, this technology, if you will, this capital, the way that we innovate around it and sort of even have an ESG sort of agenda here, all sort of very critical as we think about just Asia PAC as we move forward. When you look at 2019, what we've tried to do here is highlight the types of perils affecting, or at least in a major or significant way, the types of perils affecting Asia and Asia Pacific more broadly. And then on the right, you can certainly see a positively sloped kind of loss picture as we move over the last, sort of 20 years. And the perils that we would certainly highlight for this region, obviously tropical cyclone and flooding are sort of driving the losses on a consistent basis. And when you look at the size of the bubbles, if you will, in terms of the catastrophe events, obviously those are critical and need to have solutions in the marketplace. Moving to the next slide, again, this is a slide that I talked about a few years ago, but really the protection gap exists globally, and there's a stark reality between kind of what is insured and what is uninsured. And in Asia PAC, that protection gap is even slightly worse than what it is globally. So, in my opinion, in our firm's opinion, this just isn't a sustainable kind of outcome. And as we overlay kind of the current economic situation, the realities of COVID-19, the impacts economically to businesses, to insurers, to reinsurers, to countries, to governments, the economic toll is going to be massive. And then to have, this type of protection gap where natural catastrophe risk is, the take-up rate is not that impressive. When you just look at over this 20-year period of time, you look at the, kind of the trend of insured versus uninsured, that just isn't sustainable. So, and then on top of this, you have kind of year over year deterioration between 18 and 19. And so this really creates the opportunity for us all. And so when we talk about an impact and we talk about what we can do in the markets, I don't think there's really a better slide that sort of highlights the opportunity. But ILS, I think, is clearly the type of product that can come in and have a significant impact. We'll talk about some of the efforts recently that sort of fit along this description. But I would just say ILS and broadly the capital markets are going to have to be an instrumental part of the way we solve this. And I think there's never been a more important time to just really step back and say, kind of what are we doing to promote sustainability? What are we doing in the region to kind of address this issue? Because clearly the stress in the system, if you will, it exists even more today than it has, looking backwards. Okay, we would be remiss if we didn't in the current market sort of talk about what's happening in domiciles. So, the ability to kind of support and facilitate ILS issuance in the region, kind of a busy slide here. I won't kind of read all these numbers, but, we've seen Bermuda and Cayman with Bermuda sort of being the more active of the two, but really kind of the dominant domiciles over time. And when you look through this, if you just look at the key in the blue, you can kind of see what all of these figures mean. But not only do we show the number of transactions and the notional limits sort of put to those domiciles, but we also talk about, if you will, the efficiency of the system. So, you know, how long does it take to kind of put these transactions in place, you know, get them established? And when you look at Bermuda and Cayman, for instance, and you compare that to kind of the others, you know, clearly it's an efficient process. It works. But, you know, the attractiveness of the other domiciles is that it's more local, and we'll, you know, certainly hit on that as we move forward into kind of what can come next. But the importance of domiciles, I don't think can be understated. It facilitates issuance, it makes it more local, and things like that. And really, you know, as we look at what's happened in the UK and what's happened in Singapore, specifically in this region, I think you can really say it's there's been some progress there, and at the end of the day is going to help facilitate, you know, growth in these markets and an important part of the considerations. And specifically on Singapore, then what we've highlighted here is just you know, the transactions that have been issued using Singapore as a domicile. Interestingly, I don't think we would have thought about this a few years ago, but interestingly, a lot of the issuance comes out of North America, which I'm not sure was the intent of it. But, you know, for Singapore to facilitate, you know, global transactions, I think that obviously is a success story. But I think the skew towards North America is kind of an interesting observation. We're obviously very pleased that Japan is represented in this. And obviously MSI, you know, issued their transaction this year, I think important for the region. And then when we look to IAG kind of being the first to issue out of it, you know, it's good to see Asia and Pacific kind of broadly represented here. But, you know, looking forward, you know, this I think is going to have to sort of grow in the region, probably making an obvious statement. But you know, obviously, it's great that it's a global hub and can attract issuance, you know, from different parts of the world. But really, you know, the local attractiveness of Singapore, I think, is going to be important, you know, for those in Asia looking forward. Okay, just kind of giving a very brief bond market update. Kind of a busy slide, but we'll look to the bottom left of this slide to start with. And here are just some statistics, which I think in some way capture the activity over the past couple of years, you know, pretty well. And the, you know, the top row of data represents year to date or first half of 2020 and the bottom part 2019. So when you look through this, you know, really kind of by all metrics here, whether that's the number of transactions completed, whether that's the number of distinct sponsors kind of accessing the market in the first half of 20, the amount of issuance, and even slightly the average deal size, you can see that 2020 year to date has clearly outperformed 2019. A lot of issues around 2019, which, you know, sort of explain that. But rather started getting into that, just thinking about 2020, I think it's even a little bit more impressive kind of given, you know, kind of what happened in the middle of the, you know, first half of the year, obviously the impacts of COVID-19, the broader impacts within, you know, the global financial markets, the fact that ILS traded and held, you know, fair value, if you will, or good value throughout. The process really demonstrates the non-correlation argument that, you know, has brought investors into the space. There are a number of very important kind of distinctive marks that we've sort of passed again as an industry in the first half of the year, and then having the issuance level that we did, you know, kind of very important. I would note that when we look at the average deal size, that's obviously trended down over the past couple of years. That was a number that would have been higher if we just looked at this in 2017 and 2016 as an example. You know, something that, you know, we're obviously cognizant of, but still, you know, meaningful issuance size, you know, per transaction, And as noted in the Zenkiran case study, you know, obviously the way that you build capacity, if you're looking for a significant capacity over time, is to have multiple issuance over a short period of time. And then, you know, also call out the amount of regional representation, if you will, in terms of the coverage of these bonds. So not only for you know, Asian issuers, but also for other issuers that include Asian exposures and kind of what they're covering in the market. The APAC region accounting for 15% of the total notional amount outstanding. So as we just step back and think about that, that in itself is good. You know, for a diversifying part of the market, I think that that's a healthy number. Certainly has grown over the years, but I think when we then put that into perspective of kind of where kind of the growth and where kind of GDP is in the world, probably still underestimates the potential that exists in this region. And I'll talk about that a bit more. The plots above just kind of give an indication, if you will, kind of where the bonds have traded in the market, you know, probably, you know, another discussion, but you can see kind of the dispersion of activity in 20 versus 19. Okay, we have a couple case studies in here. The first, I think, is very relevant to kind of some of the comments we just made. The first is, you know, the Philippines cap bond that was issued, obviously the first cap bond issued out of Philippines. The non-indemnity nature of the transaction is highlighted in the notes below, kind of a moderate loss transaction. You know, the World Bank made a few comments on the closure of this transaction and perhaps already covered in the World Bank discussion. But obviously, many countries in Asia are highly vulnerable to natural disasters. I think Philippines is certainly one of those countries. And important of note, probably equally as important and looking forward, probably more important, you know, the first bond to be sponsored by the government of an Asian country. So as we look to the future of ILS in Asia and we think about kind of where the protection gap is and we think about sort of how we're going to close that and kind of where the opportunity is and kind of where the risk in the system is, if you will, I think governments are going to have to be larger contributors to this market. I think that's where the opportunity is, you know, really exists. And so, you know, good focus on this. I think this is a great case study and sort of how it was used by the Treasury of the Philippines, kind of how the trigger was customized to kind of what the Philippines, you know, wanted and needed out of this market. And so the cooperation of kind of all the parties to get that done. The graphic on the bottom is just an illustration, you know, not so much specific to Philippines, but obviously the use of non-indemnity triggers does have some benefit in terms of recovery time. You know, kind of as noted in the earlier case study, you know, Zenk used a parametric trigger and when they recovered in the Great East Tohoku earthquake, parametric triggers, model loss triggers, you know, those index triggers, really all of those have a benefit when it comes to recovery time. As we think about sort of the sustainability of economies and so forth, you know, that recovery speed is important. And as a result, I think the non-indemnity nature of these transactions will be something that will be replicated as we move forward. Just moving to sidecars briefly, the graph on the bottom would just show kind of the market capitalization or market capacity of sidecars over the, you know, the last 15 or so years. You can see that there's certainly a period of time where issuance is more elevated than others. This is a global perspective, so much like the global perspective on cap bonds, global perspective on sidecars, would note that this marketplace is a little bit more distressed or a little bit distressed, certainly on a relative basis to the cap bond market. Terms and conditions, capacity really under pressure. I would just say that this is predominantly based on sort of investor preferences. You know, the fact that there's a greater demand, if you will, by investors for more liquid products has really, you know, taken a toll or an impact on this market. Would note that those with proven track records, so those that have sponsored, you know, sidecars in the past, I think continue to execute successfully. Newer sponsors, you know, especially in the last 12 months, have kind of fallen short of target capacity raises. Some have even pulled transactions. So it's a more difficult marketplace. You could argue it's a little bit more strategic marketplace, and so the importance of it, you know, still is there, but a little bit more thought and execution, a little more strategy around execution, you know, really critical to executing sidecars going forward. And then what I would highlight is that sort of differentiated portfolios, differentiated model outcomes, geographically diversifying perils really are attractive. And so I think the reason we sort of bring sidecars into this discussion, even though, you know, Asia Pac is not terribly represented well with the number of sidecar transactions, is the opportunity for those that have distinctive portfolios that sort of meet these criteria, I think is actually, you know, quite good and quite strong. And so I think it's important for this region as we think about other ways of bringing risk that, you know, sits in the region out of it into the investor community. Now, this clearly has to be a tool as we move forward. And then, you know, to add a case study to sidecars, we wanted to highlight the first sidecar done, really the only sidecar done in Asia, sponsored by Peak Re. So this transaction has been out in the marketplace for a couple of years. You'll notice on the bottom of the slide that, you know, in our view, that this has been a very successful transaction executed in what we're calling difficult market conditions. You know, it's just highlighted on the prior page. Sponsored with a very diverse portfolio in terms of geography, in terms of the risk makeup. And I think the nature of the underwriting and the quality of the sponsor has really brought investors into this transaction. When you look at some of the key terms, you'll look at some of the things like subject business and things like that, which really differentiate the portfolio. Kind of, if you go back to the prior slide, you know, sort of differentiated model outcomes or actual results and differentiated portfolio, clearly this fits into that. So I think the last point on the page, where there's an opportunity for investors to diversify into risks that just can't be easily achieved through other mechanisms or other types of products, you know, I think this is a you know, great way for sponsors to come into the market, and we would actually expect there to be, you know, significant growth opportunities for sidecar opportunities that come out of Asia looking forward. And I think Peak has set, you know, a good example for how that can move forward as well. Okay, so, you know, with that sort of backdrop on history and kind of where the market sits, and I've already sort of hinted to some of the, you know, the, you know, where this may bring us into the marketplace, kind of just want to jump right into it. So the size of the hexagons here probably indicate, you know, our view of the opportunity, and really we're going to say that domicile expansion is an important part of the growth in this market. Obviously, Singapore had leadership in this region, I think has benefited from that, if not from as much issuance out of the region as maybe anticipated a few years ago, certainly has benefited and led the way and set the example and the model for other domiciles, you know, to grow in the region. Certainly government sponsors of bonds and you know, we've inserted the word parametric, but it's really the government sponsors of bonds that I think will be a core source of opportunities for ILS looking forward. Parametric offers some opportunities to go into, into some geographies or some types of transactions that maybe aren't available through other types or other forms of triggers. And so we've highlighted the parametric nature of the opportunity. And then kind of secondary sources, still important though. We see kind of expansion of ILS, and that expansion would be through perils, you know, through structures, through geographies, through types of sponsors, you know, kind of all of that would qualify under kind of the expansion. As we move into to weather products, obviously we just had a parametric panel. The weather products, you know, important to the region, just kind of given the nature of the perils and some of the demographics and things like that. And then as highlighted with the Peakery case, we think there's an opportunity for sidecars for the sponsors that are able to bring that risk profile and that, you know, differentiated performance to the marketplace. Okay, so let's touch on domicile expansion briefly. I think the donuts on the right, you know, just graphically shows the numbers that were shown on the prior slide on domicile. Obviously, you know, the two parts of that donut, the Bermuda and Cayman, sort of dominate this. But, you know, significant and important parts of, you know, contributions from others. Would note that on the bottom left, as we think about opportunities for Asia Pacific, this notion of being able to be more local, to be more regional, to, you know, for sponsors and cedents to be able to trade in the markets that they're most comfortable trading in, you know, we think is a real key to kind of unlock some of the growth opportunities in Asia Pacific and Singapore and we'll talk about Hong Kong in the next slide. You know, important considerations as we just think about how we're going to be able to unlock more opportunities in Asia. You know, some of the challenges are, and you can certainly see that by, as you reflect on that prior slide on domicile, some of the challenges around having the local expertise and having that grow with the transactions that get done, having the speed to basically affect efficient transactions, kind of, those are certainly challenges. I think they're very solvable. And I think we'll, you know, as more volume, if you will, more transactions, you know, come into the market, that expertise will grow pretty quickly. And so I think there'll be a way to catch up. But initially, it's just, you know, it's just part of the transaction that everyone needs to understand and take into account. But clearly, you know, less efficient initially, but that efficiency can grow over time. And then, you know, specifically on this page, kind of highlight Hong Kong. So I think Hong Kong is an important you know, domicile, and they're clearly in the stages of getting there, and not quite there yet. But we think that would be and also a very integral or important part of the market in Asia. And so we're looking forward to that coming online. And then the ability to put more products through the market. So we've highlighted, you know, sidecars, you know, again, consistent with the opportunity of sidecar opportunity or sidecar, you know, potential growth in Asia. So, you know, Singapore's reimbursement or expense reimbursement, you know, part of the equation has been very important in attracting issuers into the region. Obviously, I think as we broaden out or potentially broaden out the types of products that can be put, you know, through that domicile, also very important for Singapore, Hong Kong, or just, you know, any type of the you know, domiciles in the region. Okay, we've highlighted the nature of non-indemnity or parametric bonds already a few times, so don't want to dwell too much on that. What I would highlight here is just kind of the rationale for, you know, the non-indemnity approach, and one is simplicity, so ease of transaction, speed of transaction. Not necessarily having to worry about data quality as much as you might through other types of triggers. And it's a way to kind of start to understand how this market works, how the benefits of the risk transfer capacity that can come from ILS markets can be brought to the benefit of the sponsor. It's transparent. I think it's relatively simple to describe, relatively simple to understand, for all the constituents. There is efficiency in the recovery process, the payment speed, but there's also efficiency around disaster relief. So the flexibility to kind of use any proceeds that come from a parametric style or non-indemnity style transaction are just inherently more broad than they would be with an indemnity type of purchase. And so being able from a government perspective to be able to use those for different constituencies and be able to sort of make sure that those funds are available for any type of disaster relief, I think the efficiency around that is certainly greater with a parametric approach. And then, as I noted, just the lack of data quality or the hard to insure perils, I think there's certainly been evidence of more creativity around triggers, the acceptance of those triggers in the marketplace, and certainly look for more of that as we move forward, getting back to this notion of we just have to do a better job collectively. We all have to own the importance of solving that protection gap, because clearly the economic scenario we are in for a while is not conducive for having greater net retention around natural disasters as they happen in Asia. The case study that has already been highlighted, so I won't spend too much time on it, the Muteki bond issued by Zenk, based on peak ground acceleration from more than 1,000 observation stations. Obviously, there was a recovery, as been noted in the prior slide, around the Great East Japan earthquake. Clearly exceeded kind of the index value. This clearly exceeded the attachment point, and then a fairly rapid recovery once the transaction happened. So, kind of again, proof of concept, which we certainly like those data points as we try and grow this market and can demonstrate that the transactions have worked as advertised. And then as we think about public sector or governments or however you want to think, state sovereigns, whatever sort of terminology you want to use here, clearly the World Bank has been an integral part of the sponsoring of some of these transactions. We've highlighted here, at least the first example is the IBRD issuance that covered Latin America countries. So the coverage isn't necessarily relative that isn't an Asian-based coverage. But I think the concept that was used here, having several countries participate in a sponsored transaction, certainly meaningful capacity, the largest ever sovereign risk insurance transaction, the second largest cap bond ever. I mean, those are very important data points. Obviously, proof of concept through a recovery through the Peru bond, and again, all these data points are helpful. And then obviously the Philippines, followed with the issuance that they did. So, World Bank has been an important part of this. I think will continue to be an important part of this. But effectively, a call out to others in that regard as we look forward. And then, on that theme, just listed another example. So we've listed the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC. So we've listed, or we've shown the 21 member economies kind of listed below. APEC was formed in 1989. You can see their comments about accessing the capital markets to secure disaster risk transfer and financing. The mandate of APEC is to promote free trade and sustainable development. Kind of, again, never a more relevant time for that sustainability around economies and around development to be called out. When you look at sort of the APEC countries, the APEC economies, they account for more than 60% of the global GDP. So obviously, pretty important. Some of this, some of the covers, for instance, out of North America, more that are available today. But when you look, look to the east, certainly less. But kind of an interesting data point as well is more than 70% of all natural disasters come out of the APEC countries or APEC economies. So as we focus efforts on sort of how we can use entities like this. We just wanted to call this one out as an example for some sort of regional advocacy. There are many more. We could have had, whole slide deck on the types of institutions that can promote sort of the state or sovereign or government approach here. But, just another example of sort of a stated intent to do it, and now sort of up to the industry to sort of find ways to enable that and to make that happen. And then what I'd like to close with is just a view around opportunity. And rather than, hopefully, some of the thoughts here have been provoking and intriguing about where growth can come from. But as we just look at the deployment of capital in Asia Pacific, pretty good growth story over the last, sort of 20 years and a 9% compounded growth rate. That in itself, I think, is very interesting and compelling and highlights the importance of Asia to the ILS world. But, for us, we're just sort of scratching the surface, at least from our perspective. When you step back, take a look at all the macro trends, when you look at some of the opportunities, when you take a look at the current state of economies and sort of the prospects over the next couple of years because of the impact of COVID-19 and things like that, never more important to sort of focus on this. And as we look at the opportunities over the next 5 years, we actually think that the growth rate should and will be higher than what we've seen in the past. So our outlook for the region is extremely bullish. And hopefully for all the reasons that we've outlined, that makes sense to you as well. But having, those of you that are dialed in, listening, those of you that, can move the domicile discussion, those of you that can influence, the governmental and other types of sponsors here, really critical part of the whole equation. Okay, so I think I've used up my time. Steve, thanks for the opportunity and happy to take any questions.
Paul, thank you. That was a very interesting speech. Sorry, we've got a bit of feedback going on there. Hopefully that will resolve itself in a moment. Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Paul. Really appreciate that. Very interesting insights, very helpful for people watching, I'm sure. Just a reminder to those who are watching that you can now submit your questions through the Q&A box on the screen in front of you. Please do, and we'd appreciate some questions for Paul. But I thought to start with, you highlighted APAC as roughly 15% of current cat bond notional. How does that compare to percent of cat exposed limit? I mean, I'm not expecting you to have numbers, but in terms of your view, is that actually a reasonable percentage for the cat bond market? Or would you expect that to continue to grow given the penetration rates increasing in Asia?
Yeah, I think I would expect that to grow over time. And if you've looked at the history of the way that's developed, clearly we've seen growth over time, to get to the 15% figure we're at today. But fundamentally, when you just look at the take-up rate, you have to be a little bit of alarmed about sort of the insured versus uninsured penetration. And again, I just don't think that's sustainable. So when economies are stressed and things like that, this is actually, a very important part of not only sort of the sustainability of it, but the rebuilding of these economies, to have these types of facilities in place. And any type of major catastrophe coming in on the heels of COVID, or as we maybe aren't even out of the first wave yet, would be very costly. So we expect that to grow over time, but it's going to be, because take-up rate is as small as it is, it's going to have to be really driven by entities that haven't participated as much in the ILS market as others today.
Sure. And I guess also on the education of potential sponsors as well. So for your team, I mean, do you spend a lot of time trying to educate sponsors across the Asia region? And do you find the education process is perhaps a little bit slower there because it's a little bit further behind still?
So great point. And obviously, we're kind of living a new world today in how we sort of educate, and a little bit more challenging, you know, without some of the ability to travel and things like that. But I would say it is a little bit slower, you know, probably due just, you know, to a thoughtful, methodical approach here, and you know, thorough review and sort of culturally, all those are very important to the constituents in the region. So we fully endorse that. It takes some time, takes some education, but that's, you know, that's something that's been happening for a while. But I think, you know, kind of given those years of education, kind of given where we sit today, it feels like, you know, now is the time, you know, to sort of get a little bit of action around that. But I think, you know, culturally, you know, there's a very methodical approach here in the region, and we fully support that. I think there's been some education. It will require more, and it will find creative ways of educating, you know, remotely. But I think there's been sufficient education to you know, that in the next short period of time, whether that means, you know, the immediate 12 months or a few years, you know, we should see more issuance out of the region.
Great. Go to some questions now from the audience. We've got one which discusses the fact that ILS has helped to transform sort of insurance and reinsurance as a flexible way for capital to enter the business, especially over the last decade. But do you think that ILS participation is going to be able to continue to expand despite the recent hiccup following COVID-19 and the chokehold that's put on some funds and some sources of capital?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about it. I think there are several fundamental reasons that, you know, we will answer yes and be very bullish about that response. I think principally we've demonstrated the non-correlation again. And so that, as I keep saying, you know, repetition around proof points, you know, that proof point is very helpful. And, you know, as the broader financial markets saw the volatility, you know, that they saw, you know, ILS again sort of, you know, traded well throughout that period of time. When we get back to the founding principles of why ILS exists, that is certainly one of those. And so I think that, you know, the fact that we've been able to demonstrate that again, I think it is a helpful data point. So we do anticipate, you know, capital coming in. We don't really see, we haven't seen, you know, sort of fundamental exits or withdrawals. You know, certainly there's been some of that, and more focused on, you know, some particular types of capital that have entered the system more so than a you know, exit decision around ILS asset class entirely. But when you match up against kind of the longer term investors that are investing through cycles and things like that, I think the non-performance is important. I would say just a couple points on that. So one is, as an industry, we need to keep pushing for transparency. I can't underestimate the importance of transparency here. And that's fundamentally going to be important, you know, to the way this market performs over time. And then, you know, we just have to keep pushing ourselves on sort of the way that we look at the risk and make sure that, you know, we're capturing that perspective about risk accurately and, you know, as part of the transparency discussion. As long as we can demonstrate that we are capturing the risk, you know, the picture of that risk, you know, well, transparent about it, can keep demonstrating the type of non-correlation that we have, I think all that is fundamentally going to help the market grow.
Great, thank you. So another question from the audience. With flooding being such a significant peril across the APAC region, and thinking back in particular to the Thai floods, sort of 2011-12, do you see any prospects for more corporate sponsors of cat bonds or for flood cat bonds in particular? I know we've seen some flood peril covered in Japanese transactions in the past, but is that something you could envisage seeing more broadly?
So yes, I think so. I would say on the type of sponsor, I know I kind of covered that pretty quickly, but we think that corporate sponsors, government types of sponsors, really the getting away from the traditional sponsors of cat bonds, really being insurance companies and reinsurers, we think that that's a very, reasonable growth expectation, not only in Asia, but sort of globally, that more, sort of different types and more types of sponsors will come to the market. And so we see corporates and governments as kind of well represented in that. So absolutely, I think we're going to see, for the reasons of, diversification, which are important to insurers and reinsurers to access the capital markets, we think that diversification argument and the flexibility around structure, so can't underestimate, state that enough, the flexibility around creating innovative structures that kind of react a little bit differently, I think will be important. And then the flood peril itself, I mean, flood is obviously a less modeled peril than some of the other perils in the marketplace. It's certainly less modeled than some of the other peak perils, put it that way. And so we just need to make sure that as we continue to expand the flood coverage in ILS, that we have a fundamental understanding of kind of what that risk profile looks like. But I think when we just look at that peril, especially Thai flooding as an example, having government participation, having ILS participation, and having broader capital markets participation, I think all sort of integral to solving that equation. And coming together as an industry to make sure we really understand the risk there. I think, if we do that, I think we can put in place sustainable, coverage for flooding and, in this case, specifically Thai flooding.
I guess it's also interesting how those Thai floods also showed up some supply chain related issues as well. And this was a topic that actually came up this morning in a discussion of parametrics that supply chains and non-damage business interruption could also be opportunities in ILS. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, totally agree. Apologies, I wasn't able to dial into the parametric panel thing a bit early in my time, but what I would say is non-damage BI is a product we're really excited about. And I think the take-up rate of that, it's probably a bit early in that set of discussions to expect more, but I think take a break a little bit less than we would have envisioned by this point. But I think the product makes great sense, and so it's just it's an education thing where we make sure we, as an industry, there's enough education around the product that we're covering the types of companies affected by those types of supply chain issues, and I would even say pandemic is going to come back into this marketplace. And so I think we're still, relatively bullish that there is a place for pandemic risk in the ILS market. It will obviously be a smaller component of the ILS market than the property market, but there still is fundamentally a place, for that type of cover.
Great. Thank you. It's interesting. The pandemic question at the moment. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about different facilities and structures and whether it's insurable or uninsurable. But again, that's something that perhaps ILS Capital, alongside well-structured parametrics and as you mentioned, transparency of data is going to be key with any peril like that as well. Moving on to you discussed sidecars and you mentioned a bit of a decline in investor interest. We've got a question from the audience asking, is that really related to trapped collateral? And I guess I would add to that, have you seen the challenges with sidecars accelerate since COVID as well?
Yeah, so I would say the trapped collateral is always an issue, but probably not fundamentally the issue that's affecting sidecar performance. I think the nature of the investment or sort of the illiquidity of sidecars, I think, is held it back a bit. But I also think at the end of the day, the portfolios largely have felt similar. And so there hasn't been as much diversification opportunities, for the investors to come into sidecar transactions, because in a syndicated property cat market, the portfolios can feel the same. And so I think it's where, again, going back to some of the points I made on the slide, where we see opportunity is when we have either sort of just a portfolio that's just different, diversifying, models out well, however you would say has distinctive or unique characteristics. I think those kind of portfolios will continue to be supported and really kind of offer diversification to the market that it hasn't seen before. But there are just so many other ways to participate in, kind of U.S. risk as an example, that having a U.S. risk heavy sidecar, once an investor is invested in that, the question is what's the relative attractiveness to have another portfolio come in that looks and feels the same. So I think it's more of how can the sidecar market innovate so that the portfolio construction and so what's being brought to market actually looks and feels a little bit differently as we move from one sponsor to the next. That's where I think the opportunity sits in Asia, because of fundamentally the sort of the different type of portfolio that's out there.
Great, thank you, Paul. So we have a question related to life business, which is a slightly different topic. Are you seeing interest at the moment in the ILS market for life and health structured risks? And is this another area that you would expect to see some activity in Asia in the future?
So certainly, I think it's certainly an opportunity. Where we have struggled is, finding the sort of the sweet spot in the market around life and health deals that makes sense to, create these risk transfer types of transactions. And so I think significant interest on both sides of the trade, if you will. But we've just sort of struggled to find that sweet spot where that trade makes economic sense. So I think there's always interest to grow life and health business. I think certainly make the same arguments as we have on everything else that, life health risk out of Asia, I think would be received, really well. It's just kind of question, can we make the economics work? And then as you kind of look at then the extrapolation of life and health is kind of mortality and excess mortality and things like that, whether it's a true pandemic cover or whether it, covers a lot of things, including pandemics. I think that, again, I think that capacity is going to be out there. It's just going to be how do we create a trade that both sides of that trade, if you will, feel comfortable with.
All right, thank you. So moving on to the investor side of the equation, you talked about the potential for growth in terms of obviously seeded risk in Asia Pacific. But on the investor side, do you expect to see more capital coming to the ILS market from the region as well? And we also have a question from the audience, which is along these lines, in that can you give a brief overview on the type of investors you see and how they deploy capital, the investor base in Asia?
Yeah, sure. So I would say fundamentally, we believe the asset class is going to attract more capital. And fundamentally, we believe, some of that is going to come out of Asia Pacific. Asia Pacific already participates as investors in this, and really important investors in some regards to the space. I think we envision more. So as we just look at the relative performance of ILS compared to other asset strategies, we continue to believe that is fundamentally an attractive place to attract capital, and especially in kind of prolonged low interest rate environments, prolonged kind of negative interest rate environments. The attractiveness of ILS, I think, is even more pronounced. So fundamentally, out of Asia Pacific, we see capital coming out of Japan, we see capital coming out of Singapore, we see capital coming out of Australia, New Zealand. We expect more. you know, we are in a number of conversations ourselves with investors in those regions. I think it's still viewed as a little bit of an esoteric asset class. And so I think there's a little bit more education involved with it. But I think when we can actually have those in-depth discussions, and now, you know, now that we're an asset class that's 20 years old, there's more data to support kind of what the track record looks like. We are certainly also interested. We're in a very interesting point in the market, and you might characterize it as a little bit more of an opportunistic, you know, point in the marketplace as far as investors bringing new capacity into the marketplace. And so I think timing is actually, you know, pretty good for more capital to flow in. We're still seeing, you know, pension funds represent a, you know, larger percentage of the overall capital coming into the space. You know, we wouldn't really anticipate that changing anytime soon. Capital coming in from sovereigns, endowments, foundations, you know, things like that, still quite important. High net worth markets still important, depending on where that capital comes in across the globe. But fundamentally, it's the pension market that's really allocating capacity to the marketplace that's really going to fundamentally change the capacity dynamics.
And mostly deploying through dedicated ILS funds.
So I think the ILS managers still are largely the beneficiaries of the capital coming into the marketplace. There are more and more that, you know, are, you know, either have started to put their toe in the water in terms of investing directly, or, you know, contemplate doing so in the future. But especially as we think about the pension space, more of that, you know, for lots of reasons inherent to the pension industry, and more of that's going to go through be deployed through managers than directly. But there are exceptions, and some of those exceptions are meaningful, and we see kind of a number of those exceptions, you know, kind of slowly growing, but growing over time.
Great, thank you. So I think we've got time for one final quick question. Do you see any potential barriers to ILS activity in Singapore and Hong Kong to the growth of it? Is there sufficient infrastructure in the region yet to support sustained growth of the localized ILS markets? I suppose that's also a question of there's work to do to make sure that it can be supported as well.
Yeah, so great question. And hopefully, you know, there was a little bit of color that I provided on that. I think, you know, for the domiciles that are just starting up, the infrastructure has been, by definition, I'm losing my connection, so I'm going to be typing in a little bit here. But the infrastructure has been building as the business builds, and so I think that is to be expected, and, you know, was expected, and so I'd say are these new domiciles at, you know, kind of a run rate in terms of servicing the industry? I think the answer is, you know, not quite, or it's still building. I think Singapore, with the amount of activity they've had over the last couple of years, I think that's building and sort of the capabilities building there. You know, Hong Kong will go through a growth period if they decide that they're actually going to enact this type of legislation. So I think we just have to anticipate that there is a period of time where, you know, all the constituents, all the parties to a transaction understand, you know, that it may not be as quick and as efficient in going to, you know, to a different domicile that's more established. But I think that the infrastructure will build as the business builds. And so I think that just seems like a natural kind of expectation that we would have here. And it's not, you know, listen, I think, you know, the efficiency and for frequent issuers and the attractiveness of doing something, you know, very quick and efficient and things like that, I think there's still a lot of value there. So there's no means does the local domicile strategy detract from anything else that's more global in nature. But I do believe that to grow business, especially in Asia, to be able to trade locally, to be able to be in the same time zone, to be able to understand the regulatory framework, And even some of the sort of the political pressures associated with some of those things, it's just vital that Singapore continues to grow and that Hong Kong and others continue to think about coming into the marketplace.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Really appreciate your time today. I appreciate you participating in the conference. Thank you very much. And thank you Thanks. To everybody who watched today. You will be able to access a on-demand replay of this if you came in halfway through. Thank you for the questions, those who submitted them. We'll be back on Monday with two sessions on Monday, one on Life ILS and the potential there in Asia, and then a keynote later in the day featuring Tom Johansmeyer from PCS. So thank you for watching today. All of the links will be available for you to view on demand using the same login credentials you've used for these sessions. Paul, thanks once again. Hope to catch up with you soon once we're allowed to travel and meet more freely.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. Great to be here.